Accession number 12205, Real 2.
Mrs. Emily Drew, Real 2.
So it was near Louth in Lincolnshire. Not a long way from Mablethorpe, because I remember cycling to Mablethorpe on our days off. So you can pinpoint it roughly there. The airstrip has probably been ploughed over or something by now. And on that station I was working in station headquarters for the group commander.
Who was he? Not a chap called Cochran?
No, it wasn't Cochran. Can't read his name. His friend was that, his great buddy. Can't read my own writing. I worked for Group Captain Ward at station headquarters and for the adjutant. And that will explain why I never went on a charge. Because if I did anything wrong and the papers came through, I went into the adj and said, "You can't do this." And he used to see the WAF officer, and that was the end of that. It was nothing. It was always silly little things.
Such as?
Well, one particular one. I didn't get caught very often, but this one was, she decided we'd all book out for the station dance, and that was in the gym. And that was just down the road. And I could see no reason why, if we were on the station, and it was just down the road from the camp, because we were up within a perimeter fence, why we should book out to go into the gym to have a dance. But she decided that this was what she was going to do. So I got together with all the girls and I said, "Look, this is wrong. Let us all not book out. We can't put us all on a charge together. Right, we're with you. Okay." Two of us didn't book out. That's what I found, that people didn't back you. People let you down. I mean, with the charge of the Light Brigade had been like that, there wouldn't have been a massacre, would there? So I then decided that you can't depend on people. And it was little things. If she got a bit irritable, I used to just go in and say, "Just calm her down. She's getting a bit uppish." And they couldn't do without the typists, you see. There were only two of us could do shorthand and typing on the station.
What rank did this admin officer have?
Oh, she was only one flying officer.
Stripe.
Yeah, that's all she was. And she used to put her work into this bin, you see, they all used to bring the... She used to say, "I want that typing." And it used to get further and further and further down the in basket, and after 2 or 3 days she'd say, "I haven't had my papers back." And I'd say, "Look, we've only got two hands. I mean, look at all this on top of it."
So it was a kind of passive resistance.
Very passive. Very effective, though. We felt good about it.
Were the WAF officers of a different social background?
I think they must have been, yes. I think anyone... There were very few promotions from the ranks, as it were. They came in from public schools, straight in, officer training in. You see, there weren't any ranks to promote from in the beginning, because there hadn't been any women forces, whereas the men had already had ranks to promote from. Women didn't, so they were coming in from their own backgrounds, from public school, straight in. And I met other girls who could have been WAF officers and weren't, because they felt like me. They wanted to be part of a group, not remote from it.
Did you want responsibility?
No.
Power?
No. I was quite happy as I was.
What rank did you have?
I was only an LACW at that time. Because that was all the rank there was in the you know, office section. All the shorthand typists were LACWs. You didn't get promoted over that because the promotions were the men. But I didn't resent it. I was quite happy. I always remember them coming through the door once, and there were two of us in this office, and that one, they said, right, when did you join up? I told them, and they said to the other girl, when did you join up? And she told them, and it was about 2 or 3 months before me. And they said, oh, well, you've drawn the short straw then to me. And I said, oh, what's the trouble? They said, ah, well, we've got an odd oak leaf, and we were going to give it to the one, whichever one has been in longer.
What did that mean?
I mentioned in dispatches. And they would dish those things out, you know. And I said, well, I haven't done anything. And they said, yeah, no, but they got so many for each camp, you see. And I said, well, I don't agree with that. None of us have done anything. But, again, I didn't resent it because I didn't believe, I don't think I'd have wanted it. I didn't.
So you felt it was meaningless?
It's all medals, unless they're awarded for deeds, are meaningless. And I don't believe in them. I believe in them for people who have done something. I believed in them for the aircrew who completed 2 tours of operations when they got the DFC and the DFM. But I didn't believe in it for a man sitting on his bottom in headquarters who was doing a job that was safe and there was no valour in it. To me, a medal is for valour, not for doing a job. I still feel like that about medals and awards.
Did you eventually get promotion?
Not until I went abroad. And that became another... I volunteered to go abroad just before the war ended. But you weren't allowed to be posted overseas until you were 21. So, of course, I shouldn't have done, but at the back of my mind I thought, well, I hope this war lasts long enough. But it didn't, did it? It collapsed, and I was 21. So I thought, well, that's it. Finny. A girlfriend of mine, she'd volunteered with me. She'd decided to volunteer for the Middle East. You could choose your zone. And I said, oh, if I'm going anywhere, I may as well go as far as I can. I'll put down Far East. So she went off to the Middle East. And I thought that was the end of it when the war finished. And then the strangest thing happened on my 21st birthday. They came and said, there's a telex for you in head office, will you go up and get it? And it was my posting to the Far East. And that was the best 21st birthday present anyone's ever had.
Because did you especially want to go to the Far East?
Oh, yes, yes. I went, I was within days, I was on my way to London. And we stayed in London, in a flat in London that had belonged to somebody that had handed it over to the forces for their use. And then I went to, I was sent down to RAF Lynham, where they housed us in, what's his name, the Bath man, isn't he? Longleat House.
Yes.
Yes, we had taken over Longleat House as our base for overseas people. And I was there for a week waiting for a plane to go because they kept... We had a meeting every morning in the big hall and they'd reel off the names of those who were due to fly out, and of course those army officers and RAF officers and a little group of 4 WAF. And... every day we were being overlooked, and I thought, this is great, I'm enjoying myself here. Sleeping in Longleat House, walking around the lake, enjoying life. And then after a week we were flown out to Ceylon.
Were you all typists? All four of you typists?
Yes. Yes, they were short of typists. Obviously, we were sent out for the stats office. I think they were trying to sort out their staffing problems, establishments. And we went in there. Very interesting. We flew out, stayed a night in Karachi. They went down to Ceylon. And again, it was headquarters, of course. It was very, very nice. I remember sitting at this desk. I'd only been there 2 days, and they dig these deep trenches where they drop the huts into deep trenches, and then the bank was about was sort of opposite you, eye level in the window. And I was sat there, and I saw this thing going through the grass. I said, "There's a snake outside." And they said, "Pull the other one." And I said, "There's a snake outside." And they said, "We don't get snakes here." And I said, "I've seen a snake." I said, "She's imagining it." I said, "No, honestly, I've just seen a snake go past the window." And they had found it was a cobra when they got it. And they said, "That's funny, we've never had a snake before." And we didn't have it. I never saw another snake.
How did you like it in Ceylon?
Oh, gorgeous.
Why was it so good?
Well, again, it was a new life. New people. You saw things. I mean, even the journey down from Karachi to Ceylon, we followed the coastline because they said the cloud was... We either had to get under the cloud or over the cloud, so they decided to go under the cloud. And we followed the whole coastline down. You could see the people on the beaches walking about. It was fantastic. To someone coming from England in that time. Nowadays, people accept that sort of thing as part of life, but it wasn't then.
But I think you said that Singapore afterwards was even better.
Oh, yes, it was better because in Ceylon there wasn't a lot to do. I mean, we were situated and there was nothing happening in Ceylon. You were thrown back on your own resources. There was a naffy and the camp, and that was all. The country was lovely, but Singapore, it was all happening there. It was a city, and the clubs were open, and everybody was rejoicing. Completely different. In Ceylon, people were coming back. I saw my first prisoner of war in Ceylon, who was on his way back from Singapore. And I saw and hated the Japanese, because he was just a walking skeleton that had come out of one of the camps. And he was in transit. And I loathed and despised the Japanese then. Because you don't know about these things till you see them. You have to see these people to really understand. And I was only in Ceylon about 3 months. And then they decided to put us all on board ship at Colombo and take us to Singapore. And that was another event. We had some good days at sea. There was a mixture of RAF and Army going over. And we set up headquarters at Tanglin Barracks. We were there about... nearly a year before the army suddenly decided that Tanglin Barracks belonged to them and Changi Airport belonged to us. So they changed us over and we went out to Changi and they went into Tanglin. Which wasn't so good because it was a lot further out of town. But I hated the Japanese. I still don't like the Japanese.
Did you see any Japanese?
Oh, many, many. There were columns. They finished the airport off at Changi. With the Japanese labour. And it was then when the airport was completed that we had to move over there.
How were the Japanese being treated?
Well, far better than they ever treated our men. They weren't probably given the best of treatments, and I wouldn't have treated them very well, but they were fed and they were not harmed. But I didn't like them. I hated them. I used to see columns of them going through town and being taken to places at work. I remember being in a jeep once with some chaps and I said, don't stop, keep going, go straight through them. That's how I felt. Yeah, they did some dreadful things.
Did the people of Singapore seem to be glad to have the British back?
They loved us at first, absolutely. They threw everything open to us. All the clubs were free, could go in anywhere, you know. And they couldn't do enough for us. But at the end of 12 months, there were slogans on the wall, get out, the Brits, get out.
Why do you think that happened?
Oh, they didn't like us then. They started sniping at us in Malaysia. Well, the Malay as it was then. We used to go up to the Cameron Highlands for leave, which was gorgeous. It was just like Scotland. And the last leave I had up there, they used to say, don't go out in jeeps and things on your own. Because there are snipers out there.
Was this after the emergency started?
No, it was the beginning of the it wasn't an emergency, it wasn't as early, we were earlier than that. It was end of 46 when I came home. And it was before the trouble really hit the headlines. It was smouldering trouble that was beginning. But we saw the slogans written on the walls. We felt the discontent that we were still there. They wanted their own country back again. They didn't want us in.
Did you get fired at yourself?
No. No. No, you just heard about these things.
Was there changing attitude anything to do with the behaviour of British people there, do you think?
I don't think so, no. No, I think it was political. I'm quite sure it was political.
Were there any of the people there who, on the contrary, did want the British to stay?
I didn't have enough to do with the people to know their feelings. We didn't mix with them. We met them. Towards the end, they took one or two of the clubs back again and made them private clubs again. And we met them in the clubs sometimes, but you didn't mix. You really didn't mix.
Why not?
I don't know why not. I suppose it was because we had the clubs were all army clubs or officer clubs, and they didn't come to our clubs and we didn't go to their places. You didn't mix on a social basis at all at that time. I don't ever remember mixing.
What rank did you have in the WAF by then?
Well, when I went out, they suddenly decided that I needed to be a corporal in this new office, in this establishment's office. So I immediately put up my two stripes. And then within a couple of months, it all evolved out of the fact that all the sweepers went on strike. And the two girls in the office, myself and another girl, were the only two in this particular branch of the office. And sergeant, or whatever he was, came over and stuck a brush by my desk and put a duster on the girl behind and said, right, clean the office, like that, you see. So I said, hey, I said to the girl, no way. And she said, why? I said, because I'm not going to be picked out like that just because I'm a woman. And she said, oh, we'd better do it. And I said, there's no point in you dusting till I've swept, because I said, I shall raise the dust. So the brush and the duster stayed there for a while, and he came over and he said, are you going to do it? And I said, no. He said, why not? I said, because you've got to make a roster. And you've got to put everybody on it. And I don't mind taking my turn. But I will not be number one. So I then went and reported me to the Wing Commander, who was Wing Commander Britain. Remember Britain Toys? Little lead soldiers?
Yes.
He was at that family. And we actually went out in a crowd together with him and others. And so he was on a losing wicket from the start, wasn't he? And this chap got me in and he said, "What's the problem?" I explained it to him. I said, "I don't mind taking my turn, but I said, no way am I going to be picked out as number one." I said, "Get him to make a roster and I'll go on the roster." So, of course, my name was Mud then in the office. And they got a message down that the Air Vice Marshal needed a stenographer. So with that, I was sent up there into the very top level offices.
And so you benefited from it?
Oh, yes, by all means. I walk in and there I got my own office and there's a PA and the Air Vice Marshal.
Who had gone on strike? Was it Chinese sweepers?
The Malaysian sweepers, you know, the Malay Chinese. The lowest of the low, the untouchable sweepers, you know.
What had they gone on strike for?
Oh, I had no idea. But they weren't sweeping the offices. So it helped me a lot, that. Because I spent some very pleasant hours working for the number two of Southeast Asia Command.
How did you like being an NCO?
It didn't seem to make any difference to me, because I always felt, well, it didn't matter, because when I went up there, you see, and I'd got a corporal stripes up, and this Air Vice Marshal walked through the office, and he said, corporal? And I said, yes, thinking, oh, well, I mean, I've just had them a few months. And he said, we can't have that. Sergeant stripes. So with that, I got my sergeant stripes up. And I had great delight in going back to the other office to show them what had happened. And that's how I came to be a sergeant.
How did you use your authority?
Not at all. Oh, hopeless. I was a hopeless NCO. I remember, I had no, I couldn't tell people what to do. I'm not that kind of person. I don't like ordering people around. It's not my way.
But you like having stripes on your arm?
It was only to go back in the other office. It didn't matter to me, really. You didn't get any privileges. We didn't have a sergeant's mess or anything like that for the women. We're still just the same people. You still stayed with the same crowd.
Why was that?
Well, they were your friends. Just you didn't change just because they put some stripes on.
So we
all mix so well out there. I mean, my girlfriend, my special friend, was a sergeant, but she'd been a sergeant for a long time. She'd been from Trincomalee in Ceylon, and she was a plotter. Come across any plotters? They were the girls who pushed the planes around.
Yes.
Yeah. And her brother was a pilot. And he was actually posted to Singapore at the same time as she and I were. And so we went around in a big gang. And there was no, it didn't matter who we were. Sometimes there was edging on the crowd, we'd have Tedder's daughter. We'd have Pamela Mountbatten's in the crowd. It didn't matter out there. There was no.
You mean it mattered in Britain?
It would have mattered here. It didn't matter there. There wasn't any class barrier out there.
Why do you think there was a difference between Britain and Singapore?
Well, because here, everybody, it doesn't matter what they say today, there's still a class barrier. I think it's money that makes class barrier now rather than aristocracy. But that out there, there was no class barrier. Didn't matter who you were or what you were.
So having the NCO stripes was somewhat meaningless to you?
Well, yes, it just got more money. That's a lot. I mean, I only tried to enforce it once, and I was just coming home, and we all had to make our own crates to put our boxes in. And I was hammering away at this crate one day. You never got any help, you see. With my bits of wood and my nails. And the girl said to me, something very rude about making a noise while she was sleeping on, she'd been on night duty. And I looked at her and I said, do you realise who you're speaking to? And she said, yes. And I thought, oh, that's it then. So that was it.
You left it at that?
Oh, I left it at that, yes. She was bigger than me. So I thought, you don't pull rank here, you know.
Did you ever feel that you were discriminated against as a woman in the forces?
No, no. There were jobs I couldn't do. I mean, there'll always be jobs women can't do. I don't care what they say. And today, a policewoman is not a policeman. She cannot hold back a crowd the same way as a man can. I don't believe in this equality. And therefore, if a man gets promotion over you, it doesn't matter to me.
Did you enjoy being in the work?
Very much. As I say, it was the best years of my life.
How did you come to leave it then?
We all had to, they were disbanding, they were coming home. I did sign on for an extra 3 months to stay on, but it was beginning to change and all your friends were coming home. And in the end, you decide that, well, I'd better join them. And that's how I came home.
Was that in 1946?
It was December 46, I think, I came home. Right into the ice and snow of Britain. But I cannot complain about the treatment I ever received in the forces.
Can we go on to Kenya now? And can you tell me when and how you came to be there?
Well, briefly, very briefly, I went to London after coming out of the forces. As a lot of girls did at that time, we all got together. We joined Bedsit Land in Earlscourt and Notting Hill and all went to work in London. And I went to work for British Overseas Airways. Didn't like it. Changed jobs, worked for architects. Decided I could do better for myself. And moved around a little bit in London. Met a girl in Shell. Because somebody told me if you went to work for Shell, you could get abroad again with the Shell company. So I went and worked there and they put you in the typing pool. And then the first week I went and put my name down. Had this interview and the man said, well, how long have you been here? And I said, oh, this week. And he said, good gracious. So you sat it out in the typing pool. And I went to South America for Caracas. And I came back from Caracas and got another job in London and decided that this was a bit mundane. Beautiful job, worked in Berkeley Square. Excellent job, excellent boss. But I was getting bored. And a girl I'd known in Shell had